A Wednesday edition as we sit in the Allstate Showcase studio along a sunny, there it is, the sun again, Michigan Avenue. A little bit later, we'll talk to Frank Sennett. He will be here. He's got restaurants on his mind, I think, Rick Bayless. It's kind of a new trend where there are these programs. I've already talked to a couple people who are doing it where they are opening up sort of training centers for young, unskilled workers to help them advance in the restaurant field. Apparently, there's a shortage of cooks and things like that. Bayless is the latest. Alpana Singh is involved in moving on to further restaurant work. So we'll talk to Frank about all of that coming up. Terry Savage starts things off. You can read about her and her personal financial advice at terrysavage.com. And she's in the Showcase studio with us this afternoon. Terry, welcome back.
And
she's fired up. I will just say that. I'm
trying to be peaceful
right now because people thought last week was a little contentious, but today I think.
No, I'm not contentious with you. I'm just thinking of all the ways I hate Washington. And it gets me so fired up. I mean, today.
Okay, so let's start with today. Kevin Brady, who is the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, isn't he? Gave an interview, I think, to the Christian Science Monitor. This is all about 401k limits and tax and the tax cut bill. There was a movement to sort of limit what people might be able to contribute, and that would save in taxes. And the president said,
save
us in taxes. President said, no, that's not going to be on the table. And now Brady's saying, well, maybe it is.
Here's the deal. What could be better than a 401k plan? How wonderful if you have it. You must contribute. The younger you start and the longer you stick to it and don't ever chicken out even in the next bear market, you will have a shot at retiring. They take FICA out of your paycheck and you're not getting much from Social Security, all you 20 and 30 and 40-somethings. So there was a rumor that maybe Congress, the tax writers, would, in an effort to collect more taxes from us now, misguided effort, they would lower the amount you're allowed to contribute to your 401k plan. It's $18,000 this year. It was supposed to go up to $18,500 for 2018, and they wanted to cut that amount by $2,400. That is so counterproductive. It is so stupid. It's so unnecessary that you would think that idea would, I mean, I was really shocked that the president even knew what a 401k was and that he said, no, we're not going to change it.
So you're on Don's team on this one.
I don't put me on Don's team.
Well,
I'm saying is I was very impressed that he even knew what the president knew what a 401k plan was, knew how important it was, knew how stupid it was to limit the amount people could put in there because we got a lot of people retiring that have no money. So, of course, we want to encourage savings. And sorry, government, you'll get it when we take it out. The whole point of it is that was dead. That issue was dead. And then today Kevin Brady said, well, we could still think about limiting the amount you people could put in 401k plans.
Well, in a way,
so much money they don't care, but
in a way, this is what the Bob Corker fight started with yesterday as well, when he was on TV saying that the president should maybe let the Congress work through it. He was talking about the president weighing in on 401k,
I'm not talking about the president. I'm just saying, Congress, it's a dumb idea to limit, to cut back on, in fact, what people can put in their 401k plans. We Americans need to save because you government are messing things up that we're going to even need more money in the future.
Okay, let me ask you this, though.
As retirees.
Any idea, because I am pretty active in my 401k, and that seems like a pretty high amount. I don't know if I've ever hit that amount in an annual contribution to a 401k.
Well, I was out in the hallway. They're giving you a big raise, and I want you to put that into your 401k plan. Are you saying that it's a good idea for poor people to save but not a good idea for wealthier people to save?
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay,
no.
If things good, it's good. Save for your own retirement.
Okay.
It's a good idea.
Okay, I've beaten down. You're right. Okay, we'll do that.
Okay.
All right, so we've got that. And so I want to ask you another thing, because, and I think you don't want me to, but I'm going to anyway. There was this AP poll out, and here's the only reason I'm asking. It showed, I think, that most people, 60%, so not a big majority, but most people thought the president or the tax cut plan they're talking about will benefit the wealthy and not the middle class. The majority of the Republicans and Democrats surveyed said they thought that taxes were too high on the middle class and small businesses and that the rich people and big corporations didn't pay enough. Now, I'm not going to argue whether that's true or not. What I'm interested in is if the Congress is going to move forward with the tax bill, they're going to need to convince those people. And how do you convince those people?
Well, I think the real argument for any changes in the tax code is that we have the highest corporate tax rate of developed countries in the world. that we have a lot of experience in the past that cutting tax rates, and by the way, you have to cut it the most on the people who pay the most. I have the numbers. I'm going to bore you. I'm going to write a column, and then you can have it forever, about who pays taxes, okay? But the fact of the matter is, if what you get out of a tax cut is economic growth, and we can demonstrate that, then what you're really doing is helping all people. So I don't want to get in the tax debate now, because I want to go to the second thing in Washington that has me so angry this morning.
Is this how you and I can't join together to sue our banks?
Okay. This is terrible. The Senate voted to overturn a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau rule.
Now, this is the public watchdog that the Republicans have always hated,
you know,
right?
There's a lot wrong with the CFPB. I mean, they're a very powerful organization.
It came out of the crisis.
Came out of the Obama administration. But they've, in every case, of course, landed on the side of consumers, much to the aggravation of the banks. This is a case of your financial institutions lobbying dollars at work on Congress, because what they passed was a rule that said financial firms, banks, brokerages, even credit bureaus like, well, Equifax, can put in their contracts something that says, you are required, if you have a dispute with us, to go to mandatory arbitration. It's hard to sue a big financial institution and pay for the cost, but you can't get together in a class action suit and say, hey, Equifax, you're terrible, or hey, XYZ Bank, you've overcharged us on fees, or Wells Fargo.
Okay, let me explain what I think that means, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong.
Okay.
So if I feel that I'm wronged by my financial institution, and I feel that maybe you're a customer too and you were wronged, I can't go to you and say, let's join forces to take on the bank. I not only have to do it on my own, I have to do it basically secretly.
Yeah, first of all, you know, all those quiet, secret negotiations like with, Bill Cosby, Bill O'Reilly, perhaps Harvey Weinstein, all those agreements that were arrived at secretly, nobody knows about them. If they're mandatory arbitration, those results are not published necessarily. And the most important thing is, you, when there is a class of injured people, you cannot sue your financial institution.
So why did they do it?
The financial institutions have poured money into lobbyists. You know, I believe in the markets. I believe in financial institutions. I'm not an advocate against banks. But I think that consumers deserve at least some sort of an opportunity to have a level playing field. If there could be a class action, and if lawyers were glad to take this case on contingency, but only if they think there might be something to be gotten, if they can look at it and say, look at everybody who paid for Equifax credit monitoring or whatever deserves to file suit for why should they get their money back? There should be opportunities for consumers to have class action suits.
Okay, wait
and
a
the
second.
Senate said, no, you can't
Ladies
do it.
And gentlemen, you're going to
arbitration.
Listen to this happen live on the air.
Okay, goodbye.
As we speak, Donald Trump is talking as he's on his way to a fundraiser.
Serious?
And the crawl under what he says is that he may now be willing to negotiate on 401k plans. You just got off Don's team.
I never was really on his team, but for a minute I thought he had an idea. I can't believe it. Under the headline, Trump may be willing to negotiate on. Sure, he doesn't need a 401k plan.
Well, we'll
we
see.
All do.
I know Kim's listening. We'll have more coming up probably at 12:30, certainly at 1 as well. We're going to take a break. Dow Jones Industrial Average down 165 points so far today. It was up big yesterday, down big today. Terry Savage is in the studio. You can read more. We're going to talk about bonds and read that at terrysavage.com. But before that,
okay, let's just leave that first segment behind, but say two things. First of all, the number one thing we talked about was the fact that there could be limitations on how much you can put in your 401k plan. This is something not done yet. It's the Tax Writing Committee, the House Ways and Means Committee. So speak up. Go online, contacting thecongress.org or contacting congress.org, I think it is now. Write to your representative and say, hey, we want the opportunity to contribute as much as possible. Yeah, you may not contribute $18,000, but you know, when your house is paid off, your kids are out of college, and you have some extra money in your paycheck, you might decide it would be a good idea to defer more money and let it grow tax-free.
This is the time for your voice to be heard.
You can hear. Okay, and the other thing we made, you won't be able to have class action suits against financial companies. You can let your banks know that you thought it was a really lousy idea for them to lobby Congress to protect them against any malfeasance they have for consumers. We can no longer sue them as a class action. I've never sued a bank as a class action. I just call up the press department and say, excuse me, a lot of my readers are saying, do you really mean to do that?
Right.
Sometimes that helps.
Terry Savage. Okay, let's do bonds.
My column is called Beware of Bonds.
Right, and it's not Barry Bonds. It's not Bonds.
See, what's happened is, you know, for a few weeks I've been talking about, whoa, we're getting up here in the market. Maybe you're closer to retirement. Maybe you want to take some profits off the table. Where do you put the money? And I've had too many people post on my blog, ask Terry at terrysavage.com. Okay, so I'm getting out of the stock market. I think I'll buy a bond fund. That ought to be safe.
Well, and I mean, that was always the more stable thing, right?
But look, you can lose as much money in bonds as you can in stocks. The simple fact is when interest rates go up, bond prices fall. Now, this happens to all AAA rated bonds, U.S. government bonds. This has nothing to do with the risk of default. It is that if you locked your money up last week in a 10-year treasury note at 2.3%, right now the yield on those 10-year treasuries is 2.43. And let's say, and we could talk about why, but let's say inflation comes back or we have a Fed chairman that tightens up, and maybe the yields on 10-year treasuries go up to 4 or 5%. Then no one with $1,000 is going to give you $1,000 for your old 2.3% treasury. You get 2.3% for 10 years, you'll get your money back. But if you wanted to sell it today, you needed the cash for a withdrawal or for some other reason, you would take a loss. Instead of getting $1,000 back, you get $920. And the longer the maturity of the bond, the bigger the price decline. And when interest rates go up, all bonds, municipal bonds, bond funds that are units of bonds, all those prices go down. So you can lose money in bonds when rates go up. And that's, by the way, what's happening literally today.
Okay, so where do we protect the money if we're worried about the bear market?
That's why it's so painful, but you have to put it in chicken money. Now, look at what's happening. Not only have longer term, like 10-year interest rates gone up, but I remember sitting here not long ago when three-month treasury bills were yielding 0.36% and 6 months were, you know, maybe 0.5%. Today, the U.S. three-month treasury bill is 1.11%. Short rates have gone up a lot. Banks aren't giving you more in the CDs, but you can go to treasurydirect.gov with $100 and buy treasury bills. But short-term interest rates are going up. That's the Fed's kind of doing. If long-term rates go up a lot, then anybody who owns bonds, someone's saying in their head, well, I'm not selling my bond before 10 years. But yeah, but you're stuck getting only 2.3% interest when others could get maybe 3 or 4 or 5%.
We're just about out of time for the segment.
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. But because I think we tried this a year or two ago, but maybe next week or sometime soon, I want you to tell parents what they can do with all those U.S. savings bonds that they're
Don't buy new bonds, but don't sell the old ones. Some of the older ones are extraordinarily valuable, not only because of the interest accrued, but because they have higher floor rates and higher adjustment rates for inflation.
So you know what I'm talking about,
right? So don't get rid of your old savings.
Happy birthday, here's a U.S. savings bond.
Yeah, some of those are really valuable unless they're more than 30 years old.
Can we address that next week?
I'll do a whole column.
Terry Savage right there. Nice to talk to you again. We'll see you next week.
Okay.
All right. Did you know that every year we spend more money on Halloween costumes than we do on candy? Almost every door has candy they're buying, but not costumes. We spend more on costumes than candy, and those costumes apparently are getting sexier. So we'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. Right now we talk to, unless Frank Senna wants to talk about sexy Halloween costumes, I'm not sure. Frank?
You got to put me on the air.
I anticipated I'd have to take you right off the air, so I just never, I never went through it the first time. A sexy Trubisky, is that what you're going to be?
Yeah, sure, that'll work.
It's kind of interesting. I was reading about the history of the costumes, though, and about how Halloween didn't really become very much about kids until after World War II, that it was a little sexed up even before then. So, but anyway, we'll talk to a professor from Northern Illinois University about that, and there's a lot of attention to gender and gender roles these days. So that's coming up, but that's not why you're here, friend. You're here to tell me that soon I won't be able to find a Rite Aid store anywhere.
That's right. Walgreens, as part of the merger with Rite Aid, is going to close about 600 stores, mostly Rite Aid locations, beginning next spring as it starts integrating the stores purchased into the Walgreens fleet of 8,100 locations.
Now, this was a long struggle.
18 months.
Right, this was a long struggle for them to take over Rite Aid.
Yeah, so they get regulatory approval. They had to agree to, you know, spin off some of these assets.
And the idea is that if there are two stores, I think within a mile of each other, they're going to close one of the two.
Yeah, that's right, because they want to maintain some, you know, competitive aspects in the drugstore sector. So it'll be over 18 months. They're going to close all these stores, going to take a cost for Walgreens Boots Alliance of $450 million. But after they take that hit, It's going to save them $300 million a year by the end of 2020, they're projecting in their most recent earnings call.
Well, that's good. And let's, you know, the mayor yesterday or last week was talking about how they're moving some technology jobs downtown. And he made this comment about how he won't rest until they move out of Deerfield. I'm a little sick of that. You know, he's upset with the Governor Scott from Florida, who's here poaching jobs from Illinois down to Florida today. And the mayor's been pretty good at poaching suburban jobs, bringing them downtown.
Yeah, so the thing with that is it's a zero-sum game, right? So what you want is incremental growth. You want to, you know, add net growth rather than just, you know, like you say, it's a shell game to take, you know, one from
yeah.
here. And if it's in the region, if it's in the Chicagoland area, it doesn't really net out as a win for anybody.
It's a zero-sum when you talk about the region, but it's certainly a loss when you talk about a smaller economy that loses a corporate headquarters like that. I mean, just happened with...
Oh, for sure.
And,
yeah,
you know, and it makes sense. Yeah, Skokie losing Peapod. And all of it makes sense, too. I've talked
McDonald's.
To... yeah. Other, you know, they're looking for younger workers, and the younger workers... God knows, want to live downtown. I mean, I wouldn't want to work if I was 22 or 23 in Skokie or Oak Brook or maybe Deerfield. I'd rather be downtown. So it all makes sense. But all right, so we're moving out a little far afield. There's a story in Cranes about Rick Bayless. And yesterday, in fact, Mayor Emanuel was out to open this new incubator area for the restaurant business. I've got in front of my notes. I can't find what's the name of the incubator?
It's called Hatchery Chicago.
Hatchery Chicago. And Bayless is going to open up this sort of culinary training center there. That we talked to the guy who owns Ishnala, runs a restaurant, I think, in Rockford, too. He was on not long ago with us talking about how they're doing it in the school district in Rockford. I have a great friend who runs the Roberti House, which is a community house in Waukegan. And Mary Beth is opening up a second home to do for free culinary training to help people in Waukegan sort of get entry into the restaurant world there. And Bayless is doing that now on the west side of Chicago, too.
Yeah, so this program is going to serve a dozen or a couple dozen students at a time as it ramps up. And the cost will be nominal. There will be some cost so that they have some skin in the game. But maybe a few hundred bucks is what they're projecting. And it's going to be, you know, a few months of a program. Several sessions will be held throughout the year. And at the end of that, those, you know, couple of dozen people at a time in each class will graduate with the ability to, and the skills to get a job in the hospitality.
This is like going to the,
really good.
Yeah, this is like going to the Randy Hundley spring training camp with people who are still in the game, right? I mean, there's some big names lined up here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you've got Grant Ackett, and Stephanie Izard, and of course, you know, Rick himself, and then Paul Kahan of Blackbird. Some will also offer internships in their kitchens. It is the fact that students have to complete a one-month internship to graduate, so they have to get some, you know, back-of-the-house restaurant experience. And, you know, it sounds like if you're looking to get a start in the restaurant business in Chicago, this is a great option.
And I didn't realize Rick Bayless said in the piece that there's a sort of a cook shortage in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's a high turnover business, and there has been a shortage, and they want to, you know, increase that skill set. If you look at a lot of the culinary schools, they're like $30,000, $40,000 a year. So they want to get people who are at the entry level who can be trained up, because you just aren't going to have that huge of a workforce that's going to be able to shoulder that kind of student loan debt. Of course, at City Colleges, you do have Washburn, which Jimmy Bannis is probably the most famous alum of that. And that is an affordable, you know, two-year program in the City Colleges system. But, you know, otherwise, a program like this will really fill a big, big need.
Now, if I know you, you might put on your sexy Trubisky costume and go out and try to take one of these classes incognito. This is right up your alley, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll learn how to, you know, make a roux or some other sauce.
Maybe
know.
Some knife
all
skills.
In the sauce, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Your knife skills are pretty good. It's all in the sauce. That's what Alpana Singh says.
Yes.
There's a piece. I didn't realize them, and I didn't realize that she was actually considering running for the Cook County Board.
Until I read this, you know, I'm, you know her a little bit, and I had no idea. So this is fascinating. So, yeah, she's master sommelier, you know, former host of Check Please, goes on to be, you know, a restaurateur, and now she's sold off her interest in Seven Lions. She's keeping her other restaurants, but, you know, the thought was maybe she'd go into politics, which would be amazing, and that still could happen, but right now that's on the back burner, pardon the pun, and she's going to expand further into the
See,
restaurant.
Already those classes are paying off for you just with your linguistics.
Yeah, so she's getting out from under Seven Lions, which is across from the Art Institute. She sold her share there. She didn't feel that it needed her developmental skills in there running the place as much as her other restaurants, so she hopes that frees up some bandwidth to start some new restaurant projects.
Now, Nona cool. Tepper wrote the story in Cranes, and she said also that Singh brought the James Beard Awards to Chicago. I didn't know she was that responsible for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think she was one of the people who helped do that. You know, I think that was a team effort.
Right. Right, and I wasn't questioning the reporting about it, but I guess I just didn't realize that she was instrumental in that. And she says that's what she wants. She wants to hang out and still win a James Beard Award.
Yeah, and she's got the boarding house in River North still, at Tara and Vine in Evanston, but she wants to branch out and do some really cool cutting-edge stuff that, again, you know, brings some accolades and challenges her creativity, and I think that's pretty cool. She's a cool customer.
So does that mean there'll be another restaurant in her future?
I think so. I mean, that was the choice, right? She was saying, I'll either go into politics or more in the restaurant scene, and now she's saying she wants to open another restaurant. But don't count out the political discussion necessarily down the road.
Interesting. All right. Frank Sennett, you can read more at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
I don't want to plan your career, okay, but you take the classes, and then just in time, Alpano will be opening up a new restaurant. I think you're golden.
I can wear my costume. I'm good.
That might sink it. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, do you have your Halloween costume chosen yet? Get this. Numbers from the National Retail Federation. They say that we will spend $3.48 billion this year on our Halloween costumes. Candy is just $2.78 billion, and decorations about the same as candy. So the most on costumes, and in fact, men spend more, come on, guys, then women on their costumes, about $20 more. The average for a man, $96, and for a woman is $77. That, again, from the National Retail Federation. Of course, we are all sort of much more in tune with the way we are viewing each other when it comes to genders these days. And that comes just at the time when Halloween, probably the sexiest holiday, is a week away. To help us sort all of that out, Dr. Kristen Myers is on the phone. She's a professional sociology and director of the Center for the Study of Women, Gender, and Sexuality at NIU, Northern Illinois. Professor, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. Okay, so I was interested in this and so started reading up about the history of Halloween. I didn't realize that in the 18th, 19th century, when things were getting going, it kind of was sexed up then, that it started with women wearing a little bit less than men and trying to tempt them and all of that. Then after World War II, Halloween came to be a little bit more about kids. It wasn't before World War II. And then just to continue the timeline with the sexual revolution of the 70s, we started to sex things up again. I don't know if that's your understanding. Is that sort of how you see how all of this has developed?
Well, I think that's pretty interesting. I think with Halloween, you get to be somebody you're not. And so you can be silly, you can make political commentaries, but you can also maybe live out some fantasies that normally you wouldn't in your everyday life, all with this cover of, well, this is just a costume. But as you're noting, they matter in society, too.
And it really has gotten much sexier in the past 20 years or so. I mean, I overheard someone just this last week looking for a sexy goldfish costume. I don't know what that's about, but apparently there's confidence that such a thing exists.
Yeah, I saw a sexy clownfish costume on the internet today. So you can be a sexy unicorn, you can be a sexy hamburger, you can be a sexy anything.
Professor,
I saw a sexy Hillary Clinton costume even.
Can you send me that clownfish link? Because I'm still looking.
I certainly will.
All right, so are things going to be different this year?
No, I don't think so at all. And the industry has just making these costumes. There are designers who spend the whole year finding new things to make. There's a sexy fidget spinner, so that's obviously they're keeping up with trends. The Hillary Clinton is another example. So, no, it is, like you said, a multi-billion-dollar industry, and there's obviously a huge market out there.
Okay, so if this started in the 1800s with women lifting their pantaloons a little bit to, you know, just to be a little bit naughty, have we gone too far, or maybe it's just all healthy fun?
Well, I mean, I think what you'll see when you see something that's called sexy, you'll see a lot of flesh. So the midriff, probably breasts, and definitely a very, very short skirt. And there's certainly a tension there. Like, if women want to show their bodies and it makes them feel powerful, then they should be able to do that, and it shouldn't invite sexual harassment or assault. And yet, at the same time, I argue as a sociologist that the main reason there's such a market for it is in society, women in many places are still seen as largely sexual beings. And so when you see the sexy police officer, the sexy firefighter, and you're in a field where women are only 13% of the workforce, and every day they're fighting to be seen as more than just a sex object, those costumes are playing out this larger society view of women as not worth a whole lot more than sex.
It's interesting.
Problematic.
You kind of are saying, I think, that it can be both empowering and belittling at the same time.
Yeah, I think there's a really great Teen Vogue has become this amazing news outlet for young people. And it says, like, young women, because that's where you also will really see this is with teenagers and even middle schoolers,
yeah.
That young women want to be empowered and make their own choices, and then they don't want that unwanted sexual attention. And so we aren't in a moment where we're not beyond that yet. You know, women and girls are still going to be seen as sexy. I mean, the sexy schoolgirl costume is still one of the top sellers. And so you see that really impacting actual schoolgirls who are still seen as sex objects.
All right. So what's your advice to, advice to women, I guess, not so much girls. I think that would be a little more obvious. What's your advice to women?
Yeah. I think, you know, wear what you want. And keep in mind that the stereotypes are still pretty powerful and have limiting effects on real women in their everyday workforce, so make good choices. But ultimately, no matter what a woman wears, she's not asking to be mistreated.
I think that's the bottom line. No matter what the costume is, that doesn't imply what should be done with the costume.
Exactly.
I got to ask, what's your costume?
Oh, my gosh. I don't have one. I'm going to be traveling on Halloween, but my 15-year-old daughter is going to be Georgie from It.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So, yeah, it's cute.
Mine's going to be absent, I think. I'll just skip again this year.
Yeah, I'm just going to eat candy.
Dr. Kristen Myers, Professor of Sociology, Director of the Center for the Study of Women, Gender, and Sexuality at NIU. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.